How are we going to get monitors or wood stoves out here to Stebbins to thaw out the homes that were damaged?
Residents of Stebbins describe destruction from the big fall storm. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, November 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a secret revealed after 70 years.
I knew the guy all my life, and you know, I never knew. And my uncle, Evans Willard, was his best friend, and I don't think Evans knows.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
While the communities of Kotlik and Unalakleet have received attention from statewide media and government following a large storm a week and a half ago, residents in Stebbins feel they have been ignored. During the storm, rushing water surged through homes and roads in Stebbins. Drying racks, smokehouses, boats, steamhouses, and several homes were damaged or destroyed. Floodwaters poured in so rapidly that many residents were stranded in their homes until they could be rescued by a bulldozer. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes visited Stebbins and has this story.
It was hard getting information in or out of Stebbins for days after the storm. Both GCI and TelAlaska services were down from damaged equipment, and according to Mayor Morris Neshonek, there were no planes landing in Stebbins for the first 3 or 4 days after the storm. Frustrated and concerned over the situation in Stebbins, Kowarik organized a trip to bring in personnel in order to assess damages and consult with residents on ways of offering assistance. Anna Neshonek works as the tribal family coordinator for Kowarik and lives in Stebbins. She says that since homes were flooded, they've also become frozen. Her concern is getting people warm.
The first thing that I'm concerned about is the heating of homes that were damaged. How are we going to get monitors or wood stoves out here to Stebbins to thaw out the homes that were damaged?
The community also needs electricians and carpenters to ensure installations and wiring are safe. And while the state will eventually be able to provide new heating units, in the meantime, many families who lost their possessions during the storm are without cold weather gear.
I've made it a priority for the families who lost everything in their homes that they come up and get the first choice of the things they need. So they've gotten everything they needed except they're requesting boots and snow pants, warm gear. The main request is blankets, warm blankets.
The freeze is making many aspects of the cleanup effort more difficult. Several large containers used to collect sewage from household honey buckets were toppled or carried away. Frozen and covered with snow, that raw sewage could become hazardous when the ground thaws in the spring. It was an exceptionally strong storm surge that slammed into Stebbins last week. Part of the reason it wreaked such havoc was the paucity of adequate storm mitigation infrastructure. While some towns in the region, like Unalakleet, have been building storm and erosion barriers since the 90s, Stebbins' only defense is a decades-old seawall built from 55-gallon drums and earth. And most of it has been chipped away to almost nothing. Anna Neshonek says she was stranded during the storm when the lone evacuation route to higher ground was flooded.
I was stuck down here for a couple of hours, and while I was stuck, I was thinking about why do we have only one road to evacuate?
According to speakers and community officials at Tuesday's meeting, Stebbins was saved by how completely residents came together to help one another. Speaking on the plane back to Nome after talking with residents, Senator Donnie Olson was impressed with how much care people showed for one another during the disaster. Now, he says, it's the state's turn.
So that's what I saw was very encouraging, how cooperative they worked together and how much they pulled together in this situation. And now we as a state need to go ahead and see what we can do to step up to the plate to make sure that those that are now homeless, have lost their homes, have got some place to go ahead in winter, because it's awfully cold with this wind that's here. They need some place to go ahead and where it's a shelter over their themselves, so then they got a place to stay for the winter.
Senator Olson was the first public official to visit Stebbins since last week's devastating storm. Governor Sean Parnell, after his stop in Kotlik last week, was brought on a 30-second flyover to see the damage in Stebbins from above, but did not land. Reporting from Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Navajo Code Talkers were recognized more than a decade ago for their service in World War II. They used their native language as a code that the enemy was never able to crack. But until recently, no one knew that Tlingits from Southeast Alaska also served as Code Talkers. They got their due today when Congress awarded a gold medal to the Tlingit and Haida Central Council. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, much of their story remains a mystery.
Robert Jeff David Sr. of Haines was a basketball legend in Southeast, a top fisherman and one of the first Sea Alaska board members. Charismatic and confident, he wasn't one to keep his mouth shut when he had something to brag about. But his son, Jeff Jr., says he never said much about his service in the war.
He told us he was in the Philippines during part of it. And probably just to... He said special services. That probably, that's all he could say.
Jeff Jr. says he only learned a few weeks ago that his dad, who died in the 1980s, was a Tlingit code talker. At a congressional ceremony attended by hundreds today, the Tlingits and 32 other tribes received congressional gold medals for their service to the nation as code talkers. They worked in pairs, usually over a radio. During 48 hours on Iwo Jima, they say, 800 native language battle communications were received and translated. It took seconds, at a time when decoding by machine could take half an hour. House Speaker John Boehner says the men undoubtedly saved lives.
And after serving with honor, they did the honorable thing. They kept their service a secret, even to those that they loved.
The Defense Department declassified the Navajo program only in 1968. No one apparently told Jeff David of Haines he could finally tell his story. Former state legislator Bill Thomas heard a few years ago the Defense Department was researching Tlingit code talkers. A few weeks ago, he learned his old friend Big Jeff was one of them. Exactly what he did still isn't known. Thomas says one of the mysteries is how the outspoken Jeff Sr. was able to keep quiet about it.
I knew the guy all my life, and you know, I never knew. And my uncle, Evans Willard, was his best friend, and I don't think Evans knows. And we were talking last night. Evans is probably rolling in his grave or in heaven laughing at Big Jeff for having kept the secret that long.
Ozzie Shakely received the Congressional Gold Medal on behalf of the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida. Five individual Tlingit men, all deceased, were honored with silver medals. They are Jeff David, Richard Bean Sr., George Lewis, and brothers Harvey Jacobs and Mark Jacobs Sr. A little more of the service history is known of the Jacobs, who were from Sitka and Angoon. According to a history published in 2008, the brothers joined the Navy and skipped basic training to serve on picket boats, first in Southeast Alaska and the Aleutians, and then in the South Pacific. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
ConocoPhillips announced today they are adding a drill rig to the Kuparuk oil field on the North Slope. This is the second rig they've added since the new oil tax cut bill was signed into law this year. The drill rig they installed in May is producing 1,600 barrels of oil per day. ConocoPhillips President Trond Erik Johansen says the newest rig will start producing in January, but it's not as easy to extract oil from the massive field as it used to be.
The way we drill today, we go further out on the flanks. We drill more convoluted well bores. We need more high-tech technology to go out there and do it. And yes, it is more difficult. So it costs a lot of money, but under the current tax system we have now, after SB21 was passed, we can make this to go around and actually make economic sense. So that's why I'm doing it.
Johansen says oil tax reform also motivated his company to move ahead with their projects in the greater Moose's Tooth field. They are applying for permits from the Bureau of Land Management. According to the BLM, it would be the first oil and gas produced from the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, and on federal lands in the state. Johansen says the first step in developing NPRA is finishing the infrastructure on Colville Delta Unit 5, which should start producing oil by late 2015. They already plan to develop that area even before the new tax plan. If the Greater Moose's Tooth field is developed, it could add 30,000 barrels of oil to the pipeline per day. Currently, oil production on the North Slope is declining by about 6% per year. Johansson spoke at the Resource Development Council conference in Anchorage. The Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission has revised their proposed hydraulic fracking regulations again. Some of the new rules were aimed at giving the public more information about the chemicals used in the controversial oil and gas extraction method. But in the latest version, companies are allowed to withhold some information from the public in order to protect their trade secrets. If the regulations are approved, companies could mark some formulas confidential, and only the AOGCC would see them. If the public wanted the information, they would have to seek a court order. Barrett Ristroff with the Wilderness Society says this weakens the provisions that protects the public.
Also, I think this is an issue of such great importance to the public that the public should know ahead of time what's going on in and around their property and the areas where they might hunt. It shouldn't have to take a court order, which can take months and even years to get that information.
Ristroff says waiting for a court order could be especially dangerous if there is a medical emergency potentially linked to groundwater contamination. During a hearing about the proposed regulations in October, oil industry representatives argued that the specific chemical mixtures for fracking fluids needs to be protected so other companies do not steal them. They said without protections, they wouldn't be willing to use their best recipes in Alaska. Other changes in the regulations say that if landowners don't give the operators permission to gather baseline data on their water wells, then the companies will not have to test the wells later for contamination. Though baseline data gathering will be required on public lands, follow-up testing will only be necessary if the commission requires it or a landowner complains. The regulations will be discussed at a public hearing on January 15th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, celebrating one of the lesser-known legacies of Ted Stevens.
It was the first map of the United States that had Alaska in the correct proportion, in the correct position, and Hawaii in the correct proportion and the correct position.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
The state's insurance director is resigning. Brett Kolb is leaving to become development director at Victory Ministries of Alaska, a Bible camp and conference center based in Palmer. He has been on the job at the Division of Insurance for 18 months during a time of incredible upheaval in the health insurance industry with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Kolb says he doesn't worry about leaving in the middle of that change.
The division is well-staffed. We have good people in place who understand the difficulties that are being faced. So between that and having a deputy director in place in Juneau who has insurance industry experience, I'm sure it will go on without a misstep.
Kolb's last day with the division will be December 19th. He's working with health insurance companies now to figure out how to allow at least some individual plans that were supposed to be canceled starting in 2014 to continue. President Obama announced the so-called fix to the Affordable Care Act earlier this month following public outcry over canceled plans. Kolb lives in the Valley and says he's looking forward to a much shorter commute with his new job. The Anchorage Assembly heard final testimony Tuesday, last night, on what has become a controversial proposal to build a rec center in the city with indoor tennis courts. The Assembly never asked for money for the project, and accusations flew about how the tennis appropriation came about. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
The tennis issue couldn't have come at a worse time for the Assembly. They're finalizing their 2014 operating budget and preparing a capital budget request to send to Juneau, among other things. The Assembly reordered the agenda to take care of more pressing issues and put tennis off until nearly the end of the night, on what was a marathon day for the body. So at around 10 o'clock, a woman waiting to testify on tennis walked up to the podium without giving her name.
I don't know what the heck this even is, but I am absolutely horrified at the way you guys are passing this around and not doing things in order. And we ought to be, we've had the tennis people down here. We're here to testify on something important.
Ma'am, we'll get to you. Thank you. Thank you.
The woman then walked out. About an hour later, testimony was allowed. Assembly Chair Ernie Hall acknowledged the delay.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, you know, our apologies. We know that a lot of you are here to talk about tennis courts. This is what we run in sometimes when we have a lot of testimony and we get things backed up.
The Assembly's been considering whether or not to fund the Northern Lights Recreation Center, which would include indoor tennis courts. The legislature approved millions of dollars for the project, but the Assembly never asked for it. Tennis Association officials admitted they spoke with Mayor Dan Sullivan about the project and then lobbied Juneau directly, but didn't consult the Assembly. Racing the clock toward midnight, testimony from bleary-eyed supporters sounded like this.
My name's Matt Hemry. I think the Alaska Tennis Association did everything that we thought we were doing correctly to pass this project through the public process.
My name is Scott Kohlhaas. I'm also currently serving as the president of the Alaska Tennis Association. The issues that are going to be decided this fall and tonight are the issues of whether or not high school tennis as a program is going to live or whether we're going to let it die.
I'm Zarina Clendaniel. I support building a public indoor tennis facility.
But Assembly members didn't sound convinced and had questions about the appropriation. Anchorage Representative Lindsay Holmes, who holds a seat on the House Finance Committee, reportedly secured money for the project. Assemblymember Bill Starr said he'd been doing some research on how the funding came about and spoke with Republican Representative Bill Stoltz, co-chair of the House Finance Committee.
I reached out to Bill Stoltz, and he agreed to meet with me today along with Chairman Hall and Mr. Trombley. And when I gave him the story that I had, and maybe it is a story, I said, "What's your story, Mr. Stoltz?" And we sat there in a totally good way, and Mr. Trombley and Mr. Hall, they said that Lindsay Holmes was told that she could have $4 million for her district for that project. Does that make any difference in terms of legislative intent coming out of Juneau?
Mayor Sullivan admitted it was his office that came up with the $10.5 million amount. The Assembly Chair says the body will likely take a vote on proposals related to the issue at their next meeting, Tuesday, December 3rd. The two proposals on the table would allocate less money for the project. Earlier in the evening, the Assembly approved requesting $10.5 million for the facility in next year's capital budget request to Juneau. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Anchorage residents will get relief tomorrow from the clear and cold weather that has set in over the last few days, but the transition could be messy. Forecasters expect temperatures to hover in the mid to upper teens tomorrow, with up to 2 inches of snow falling in the late afternoon and evening. National Weather Service forecaster Bill Ludwig says the snow will likely turn into freezing rain early Friday morning, which will continue through most of the day.
At this point, it really doesn't look like we'll have a heavy freezing rain event, that if we get some, it'll be light, but sometimes you don't need a whole lot to make things pretty nasty.
Ludwig says he expects less than a quarter of an inch of freezing rain accumulation. Temperatures are likely to rise to around freezing by Friday afternoon, then between 3 and 5 inches of snow is expected for Friday evening. The National Weather Service is forecasting similar conditions for the Mat-Su Valley.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. The Older Persons Action Group, publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families, can be read online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The federal government has finalized new guidelines on the use of sea otters by Alaska Natives. The change is aimed at better defining a requirement that hides must be significantly altered in order to be considered authentic Native handicrafts or clothing that can be sold to non-Natives. Andrea Medeiros is a spokeswoman for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which has been working on the revised wording for more than a year.
These are guidelines, and they're to help the Alaska Native artisans to understand what exactly qualifies as significantly altered.
The final guidelines say a sea otter will be considered significantly altered when it's not recognizable as a whole hide and has been made into handicrafts or clothing. The language goes on to define that in more detail. It's a positive step, according to the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, which teaches classes in the Native tradition of skin sewing. SHI Chief Operating Officer Lee Kadinger says the new wording still needs some adjustment, but overall, he says SHI appreciates the change. Kadinger thinks it helps clear up a term that he says has caused significant harm to artisans over the years.
Clarifying significantly altered to more align with the Marine Mammal Protection Act's original intent is going to help continue a tradition practice since time immemorial without fear of prosecution, as has been in past. Protecting this inherent cultural right is not only good public policy, but it supports and preserves cultural diversity and respects the traditions and lifestyles of Alaska Native people.
Sea otters are a federally protected species, and only coastal Alaska Natives are allowed to hunt them. The revised language was in part prompted by concerns that unclear regulations and past enforcement actions had discouraged Native use of the animals. According to the agency, the final guidelines are based on input from a 2012 workshop with Native artists and hunters, as well as extensive public comments on draft language that came out last spring. Some commenters found the draft language too restrictive. Others oppose the change as an attempt to weaken protections and encourage more hunting of the animals, which have come into conflict with some of Alaska's fisheries. The state of Alaska has more time to develop a plan to improve Fairbanks air quality. An Environmental Protection Agency deadline that passed last year is now December 31, 2014. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the new timeline also comes with more stringent requirements related to addressing Fairbanks wintertime fine particulate pollution.
The original deadline for a plan to get Fairbanks into compliance with federal air quality standards came and went last December as the state struggled to generate measures to reduce smoke from wood and coal burning. The new December 2014 due date is the result of a lawsuit brought against the Environmental Protection Agency by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Cindy Heil, a Department of Environmental Conservation Air Program Manager, says a case ruling required the EPA to enforce fine particulate pollution regulations under a different part of the Clean Air Act.
So they have now tried to make it consistent for everybody is giving us and the other portions of the United States that have non-attainment areas new deadlines to work for.
The extra time comes with a hitch. Heil says the section of the act now being used requires more in-depth consideration of means to address Fairbanks pollution.
We have to show reasonable available control technology on our point sources and that we are taking all reasonable available control measures.
Heil says the new section also requires looking at additional sources of fine particulates. Fairbanks wintertime air pollution is primarily attributed to wood and coal burning, but Heil says the state now also has to look at so-called precursor emissions from other sources that can transform into PM2.5 in the atmosphere.
We now have to identify all those precursors, and either we have to show that they're not a major problem or they are a problem and how we would deal with them.
Heil says research indicates precursor emissions are not a significant contributor to Fairbanks fine particulate pollution. The state is in the process of taking public comment on proposed air quality control measures, and Heil says the DEC anticipates having a plan into the EPA next summer, 6 months ahead of the new deadline. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
An event at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Rasmussen Library on Monday celebrated what would have been the late Alaska Senator Ted Stevens' 90th birthday. The commemoration also marked the opening of a new map exhibit in the library that houses Stevens' collection of Senate papers. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
There are many tales that are told of Ted Stevens's nearly 40-year career in the U.S. Senate, like how he wore his incredible Hulk tie on days when he knew he'd have to do some serious arm twisting to get fellow senators' support for a piece of legislation he was pushing. Marie Matsumo Nash has heard a few of those tales during the 29 years she worked for Stevens, and she shared one of them at Monday's commemoration. Nash says many years ago, Stevens asked her at the last minute to cook some salmon for a meeting of Republican lawmakers in Washington.
We had to dress it up. We were peeling the skin off and putting sliced cucumbers on, making it fit for the senators that were going to be eating it. So that was kind of fun. It was something I had never done.
Now there's another Stevens tale to add to the lore. It's the story behind an exhibit of Alaska maps related to the senator's career that UAF graduate student Susanna Dowds has set up in the Ted Stevens Papers Project in the Rasmussen Library.
It was the first map of the United States that had Alaska in the correct proportion, in the correct position, and Hawaii in the correct proportion and the correct position.
Dowd says it's called the Stevens map because early on in his Senate career, he directed the U.S. Geological Survey, the USGS, to publish a map that would clarify once and for all that, contrary to how the state is often depicted on many maps, Alaska is not some disembodied landmass located somewhere just off the coast of Baja California.
When Alaska first became a state in 1958, cartographers just decided to put Alaska as an insert south of California.
Dowds says over the years, cartographers typically stuck Alaska somewhere near the lower left corner off the lower 48, and usually at a much smaller scale than the rest of the states, because Alaska is so big and so far away that it was impractical to show it in its correct place and size. After it came out in 1975, the senator widely distributed copies of the Stevens map, and it quickly became very popular, especially among educators.
He sent off copies to all the schools in Alaska, and we got letters from teachers, his office did, and they asked for extra copies because their students didn't really know where Alaska was in relation to the rest of the United States.
The Mapping Alaska exhibit will run through May. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Stebbins, Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Tim Ellis in Delta. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C., and Ann Hillman from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
And by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com. Those living with asthma know that each day their life can take several different routes. So take care of yourself with daily medication and you'll be well-rested and eager to take on the day. Miss taking your medication and you'll end up with restless sleep, days at home sick, or even in the emergency room. So treat your asthma even when you're feeling your best to keep you from your worst. Information at asthmainalaska.org or 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.